Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the New Books Network podcast in Media and Communications and Language. My name is Lee Pierce, she, hers pronouns, and I am at the State University of New York at Geneseo, and I'm very excited to have with me today Dave Dillon, who is the author of an open educational resource textbook, which is something we haven't had on the podcast before. I'll talk more about that in a moment. The title is Blueprint for Success in College and Career. Dave is over at Grossmont College. And while we typically don't do textbooks on the New Books Network, I'm excited to bring this project on because, first of all, it's an open educational resource, meaning that's, so OER for short is what we'll call it, meaning it's available for anyone under the Creative Commons license. The other reason is that a lot of our listeners on the New Books Network are not only academics and generally educated readers, but also teachers, people who are involved in campus administration and college life, and even family members and supporters of students. And I really just think that this is a unique opportunity to bring a resource to you that's absolutely free, very, very good, and useful for a variety of applications. And I'm also happy to announce that Blueprint for Success recently won an award from the textbook. It won the It won the Textbook Excellence Award from the Textbook and Academic Authors Association. Dave, are you with me?
I am.
Great. And one thing I did forget to mention is that Blueprint for Success was published under the Creative Commons license from Rebus Community Press. All right. So, Dave, you want to say hello? And you use he, his pronouns, correct?
I do.
Great. Will you say hello to our listeners?
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm excited. So this is a big deal. I heard a lot about this book before I came to know it. I've used it a lot in advising. And I just quickly want to read, and you can kind of guess what this is. The scope of this book is really breathtaking. It's 60 chapters or something like that that cover every possible imaginable thing that maybe a college student, especially a contemporary college student, could encounter. And I think one of the reviewers for the book from the Textbook Excellence Award summed it up when they said that the book should be valued for making succeeding in college possible for a wide audience. It is a straightforward, useful, and accessible textbook that makes it easier to navigate college and develop skills for succeeding beyond the classroom. And that's really one of the things that I really like about this book. And part of the reason I brought it on the podcast is because, you know, people have to learn how to do college and being successful. You know, it's an inner language, and that's part of the reason we're on the language channel. And we forget that this isn't something that a lot of people are just born knowing or are raised in that kind of situation. And as colleges become more first generation, more non-traditional students, we are going to need ways to catch them up on some of that tested knowledge that we lose, I think rightly so, as we start to democratize education. So do you want to say a little bit about the book and what brought it into being?
Sure. Thank you again for this opportunity and saying kind things about the project. I think to your point, we as educators often expect students to know exactly how to navigate through college. And the truth is that many students never learn the skills that are needed in order to be successful, or they're learning them on their own, or they're learning them after the fact that it would have been useful for them to know from the beginning. So this textbook was created for a number of reasons. One, it's for a class that I teach on my college at Grossmont in San Diego, College and Career Success. But it's also created for any college student who is either looking to gain new skills and strategies for learning and how to navigate the culture of college, and also for students that might just need a refresher for how to study or how to effectively use time management, or maybe to figure out what they're going to do for their major or choose on their career. And then I'm going to launch into really how this book came about from the beginning, if that's okay.
Take it away.
Okay. So I don't know if in outside of California, there is the same term that we use called freeway flyers, but it's a common term for part-time instructors or adjuncts. So we refer to freeway flyers as those that are working in multiple districts or multiple colleges, and they're literally getting to the maximum amount of what they can, where they can work, and then on the freeway getting to the next college or the next district to teach more classes or counsel more students. And so In that experience, at one point I was working in four different districts at the same time and really feeling fortunate to be able to have the learning materials for that particular class on that particular day and time at that particular campus and sort of going crazy and thinking that it was strange that I would only be using this textbook at this college with these learning materials and these assignments and these exams, and then something completely different for roughly the same class somewhere else. But because of copyright restrictions, I wasn't legally able to really share materials back and forth. And so the result of some of that moment of thinking that I was going nuts was to say, I think I know enough about this field to be able to create my own resource. And if I was ever going to get to be full-time professor, then that was what I was going to set out to do. So I was fortunate to become full-time in 2007 and set out on this project to create a textbook for a one-unit study skills and time management class that I was teaching at the time. And I projected that that was going to take about 2 years, and that was a very naive projection. It actually took 5 years. There were two national publishing offers along the way. One was from a large publishing company. One was from a small one. Neither of them seemed like the right fit for what I thought I was trying to accomplish, which was really just to be able to use the content for my classes and then and find a way to share it out with other instructors that might be interested in the same materials. And publishers, I just wasn't confident that they were going to market it in a way that I thought was going to be useful. The other one, there were some discussions about content control that I wasn't comfortable with. And the main goal for me was never to make profit. It was to be able to have the best content for the students that I was teaching. And so I passed on those, hoping that I wasn't going to regret it, and kind of accidentally found Montezuma Publishing, which is on the San Diego State University campus, a university press. And they specialized in doing readers for professors who were creating things similar to what I was trying to create. And I was very happy working with them. They did the formatting and the binding, helped with the cover design. And I had hired my own editor. And then we put together this roughly 100-page textbook that came out with a traditional copyright. This is before I knew about OER. And one thing that was really important to me even then, this is now 2014, was the price of the textbook for students. So Montezuma and I had negotiated a $29 price that this was going to be sold for the bookstores to students. And I thought that that was reasonable for what it was. We couldn't get it any lower than that because of the small print run. But I was pleased that that wasn't a $100 or $200 or $300 or $400 textbook. And shortly after that, I realized that my bookstore had marked that up in less than a year to $42. And that was terribly alarming to me. And I was starting to see firsthand that the barrier, even at $29, for some students to be able to purchase the text was something that was causing them not to have the text in the class, which of course is the purpose of having the textbook is to put it in your students' hands. And so at $42, I was really thinking, that's really more than what I want students to be paying for. And what might I be able to do to try to address that challenge? And it was about then that I started to learn more about what OER, open educational resources, are. And I was certainly not ready at the beginning. I think I had a reaction that might be typical for most faculty when they start to learn about OER. I had questions like, what about quality? And what about accessibility? And what about peer review? What about print options, sustainability? A lot of those questions, and I didn't know where I could get information to answer them. But as I got further along, I not only learned more about the dramatic increase in textbook prices over the last 10, 20, 30 years, which is contributing to student debt, and also the direct relationship between textbook costs and student success. So for instance, there are many studies that are pointing out that somewhere between 50 and 60% of college students are not purchasing textbooks at some point in their college career strictly due to cost. And when I started looking at that, I started looking at OER in a slightly different way, thinking, could this be an option for me? Could I find those answers to the questions that would be satisfying enough for me to really consider jumping into OER? Because if I could make the textbook as of high quality as the commercial textbook, and it was going to be free to students, that seemed like a win-win. I was making pennies on royalties, which again was not the main incentive for me to get the book out there. So I finally got to a point where I had gotten answers to all of those questions that were at a satisfactory level enough for me to be able to really start to think about how can I make my textbook in OER. I'm going to jump in with a few other things that I learned along the way that really made me want to jump in. So one of those is first day access and post course access. Oftentimes students will either wait for a variety of different reasons to buy a textbook. Maybe they are waiting for their paycheck, or they're waiting for financial aid to come through, or they're waiting to see if their instructor actually is going to use and assign the textbook. Some instructors will only use certain chapters, and so it's challenging for students to pay $100 or $200 for a textbook only to be responsible for one or two chapters in it. And then post-course access, I think, is also very important for students. if students might be taking courses that span multiple semesters, or if they have to retake a course that they failed, if they are using a text for reference for an advanced course, or studying for higher education entrance exams or certification exams, if they're changing careers, any of those reasons might mean that the student would want to have the content from their textbook after the semester that they originally had it. And in the world of digital access codes, it would mean that a student would have to purchase the textbook again to have the content. Whereas with OER, students have that textbook. They didn't have to pay for it in the beginning, and they are welcome to have access to it forever. The last two things that really made me go, I think I refer to it as the straw that broke. One scenario was that I had a number of students that would tell me that they went to the bookstore to buy the book, and the bookstore didn't have the book in stock. And I embarrassingly admit that I didn't believe the students originally when they said that. I thought that that was an excuse. But I had heard it enough times over multiple semesters that I finally did an experiment. And I went to my bookstore maybe 2 or 3 weeks before the semester started. 2 weeks before, 1 week before, first day of classes, 1 week after, 2 weeks after, 3 weeks after. And sure enough, there were points in time where the bookstore was out of the book. And I was really naively puzzled by that. I came to realize that it's a fairly common practice for for-profit bookstores to purposefully understock the books. And that is generally because they are often able to have a percentage contracted with a textbook publisher to be able to return books that aren't sold. And so from a business model, of course, it's brilliant for a bookstore to understock because they're taking less chance to lose revenue. But from a student standpoint, again, for those examples of the students that might be waiting on a paycheck or for financial aid or for whatever reason, if they don't buy the bookstore, don't buy the book right at the beginning of the semester, and they go in a few weeks after and the bookstore doesn't have it, then the bookstore has to reorder and it takes more weeks for it to come in. The student gets further and further behind. And that is directly causing lack of success for many students. So I was honestly livid when I found that out, because to me, it seems like the real mission of the bookstore should be to have the book available for the student whenever the student wants or needs to have it. And then the very last one was, I'm counseling faculty, so I see a lot of students in my office. And I've seen thousands and thousands of transcripts. And so it's very rare that something will surprise me or there's something that I haven't seen before. This particular student, right when I was getting close to the cusp of going OER, came in and had something on their transcript that I'd never seen before. The student had a transcript where they were taking 5 full-length semester classes. They dropped 3 of those only to re-register for different sections of the same 3 courses in the short-term session of our semester. So we have 16 weeks that are full-length semester, and then many colleges have short terms. This was an 8 weeks or second 8 weeks that they were taking the courses. And so in my head, I was thinking, what would make this student think that they could pass these courses in the short term if they couldn't pass them in the long term? And why would they do that? And so I as respectfully and politely as I could, asked the student why, please explain why you're doing this. And the student said, look, I'm really embarrassed to tell you this, but the truth is I can't afford my textbooks. And I thought I could skate by and pass these classes without the textbooks. And in these two classes, I can, but in these three classes, I cannot. But now I have a part-time job, and I found that these three sections of the same courses taught by different instructors are using different textbooks that are cheaper than the other ones. And I think I can scrape up enough money to be able to purchase them. And to me, that was just groundbreaking. I feel like I should have known, and I did know that many students were struggling with financial concerns, but I hadn't seen it quite presented like that. And it had a very big effect on me, a visceral effect. I knew that was not isolated. 3 months after that student came in, I found out that the student was homeless. The student was living with their brother and their father in a tent in a park. And I knew that I needed to do something in order to try to better support the many students that are in those situations, and OER was one of those. So coming full circle back to this textbook, I was fortunate because the university press had allowed me to retain my own copyright for what was originally produced, this one unit study skills and time management text. I then was approved for a one semester sabbatical leave at my own college in order to curate a larger OER. This one was going to have a career unit and some finance units, a health unit. It was going to be all encompassing for this first year experience, college and career success, really extended orientation for college students. Especially community college students, but not limited. I think it's also helpful for four-year students. And so that started, it gave me an opportunity to kind of purview what else was out there. And much to my delight, I found three already openly licensed college success textbooks. Two were from Lane Community College in Oregon. One was from Lumen Learning, also in Oregon. And one of my true favorites was a text called Foundations of Academic Success, Words of Wisdom, that was produced at SUNY. And Thomas Priester was the editor. And this was a non-traditional collection of essays from students, classified staff, faculty, and administrators that were all giving advice from their own personal experience about how to be successful in college. And they were taking some unique aspect of that. And so I was able to take those essays and kind of sprinkle them throughout the text that I was curating, along with some high quality content from these other sources and my own original content, and really try to put that Frankenstein project together and make it consistent. It was peer reviewed and student reviewed, went through an accessibility review, and then was piloted in spring of 2018 and officially released in the summer of 18, and now this is my fourth semester using it. And much to my surprise, I humbly share that this text has already been adopted with zero marketing, only from word of mouth, at about 16 colleges and universities throughout the United States. Most of those are California community colleges, but it has also been adopted in Oregon, New Jersey, New Hampshire, and there's a school in Michigan that will be adopting it soon. So that has been fantastically rewarding, and I still feel very much like this project is a work in progress. So I'm always listening to students and instructors with feedback, and constantly editing that. And that brings me to share that the most common question that I get from other instructors who might have heard about it or who are looking for a resource for their class or are looking for an OER is, do you have ancillaries for this project? And so I have been trying to diligently keep up with the great demand for the ancillaries. And that has really led me to be introduced to Lee Pierce. And so I will share that now there are PowerPoints that instructors can use for this text. There is a quiz bank for multiple choice questions for most of the chapters in the text. And then we're working on a cultural competency chapter in partnership with a global studies fellowship at Stanford University. That will be, is scheduled to be completed next month. And one of the ones that I'm most excited about is this project that Lee and I are collaborating on. It's an audio version of the textbook, which far as I know, there aren't very many audio versions of textbooks that are out there. And I think sometimes for good reason, because textbooks are honestly often stale and not all that interesting. This particular idea about an audio version was born from some students who said, hey, look, I have a lot of time that I spend commuting on the bus or waiting in a variety of lines, or I might listen to this if I have the opportunity on the treadmill or on an exercise bike or in other ways that students are often connected to audio versions and podcasts and music. So if I had that audio version, I would listen to it. And their words, the students' words were, I think it would reinforce my learning. So to me, that was kind of a no-brainer to try to get started with this. And the truth is, I didn't really know what I was doing because I am not an expert with audio or podcasts. But I've started to educate myself, and the publisher for the project, the Reuse community, has put out a call for anyone that might want to collaborate on this. And I'm so thankful that Lee answered this call. And as you may know, she's a public speaking instructor. And so she is helping with allowing the opportunity for her students to record themselves reading one of the chapters. And Lee, I'll let you take it from there because you know more about that part than I do.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah. I have to say, I talk about this project all the time. What I don't want to do is turn it into, but since we're on the New Books Network, and I think the purpose here is for the audience to get a sense of what the book is like, let's actually take it back to the book, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Sure. Okay. Because, yeah, and you and I have done this interview in a couple different contexts, so it's sort of hard to know who the audience is for each context. But
well, and my apologies for rambling.
No. You don't need to apologize for anything. All right. So let's go back to the book. So there's a lot of great stuff here. And part of what I'm thinking about is if I'm a listener and I maybe advise students, or maybe I'm a family member of a student, and I'm thinking about this as a potential resource that I could draw from or that I could give to people that I know. One of the sections, the very first section, is this collection called Words of Wisdom that you had mentioned previously. And I just wanted you to talk a little bit about why you included the Words of Wisdom section, why you kicked it off that way, and what you think is valuable about that section of the book.
Well, I think I mentioned that this Foundations of Academic Success, Words of Wisdom, is a collection of essays. And I think that that's unique in itself, because most textbooks from my perspective are coming at it from a, here's the knowledge and it's being projected onto you, and it's coming from a hierarchy. Whereas the collections of essays is much more like a casual conversation between two people on equal footing. It's one person giving advice to another person. And that was so, it was so interesting to me. It captured my attention. I thought it would capture my students' attention, which it has. And I think that, students are not necessarily expecting that, because most of the other textbooks are not like that. When they come across something that's different like that, it does grab their attention. And then it's much easier if the rest of the textbook is laid out in that traditional format, that they're more apt to dig in and read it. And they get excited about looking for the next Words of Wisdom chapter that's coming maybe 5 or 6 chapters ahead. Because as I said, I sprinkled those in different places. Did that answer your question?
Yeah. My students have really liked that part of it. So I wanted to kick off with that section of the book because it seems to be the one that they most valued overall. I don't know if that's just the beginning of the book, so they never read the rest of it or not, which does bring me to the next question. So a lot of my students have mentioned that 60 chapters of kind of life advice can be daunting. So do you have particular parts of it that you focus on, or did you more imagine that this would be a resource, almost like a Wikipedia, and that different instructors or different administrators would draw the students' attention to different things at different times?
Yes, that's such a great question. I think that one thing that I try to tell my students who might be intimidated by the full text is 456 pages, and as you said, it's 60 chapters. The chapters are short, so it is supposed to be bite-sized information that they can grasp. That again has the tone as though they're having conversation with someone instead of a fire hose of information coming at them. I'm sorry, I forgot the second part of your question.
Part of the question was just how do you kind of help the students navigate the chapter?
Oh, yes. You were alluding to what other instructors were doing too, because the textbook is open, and in this case it has the greatest amount of flexibility for others to do what they want with it. It's the most flexible license that's out there of the Creative Commons licenses. So an instructor could make their own version of it. They might not like chapter 4 and eliminate it, or take some of their own content, if it's not copyrighted, and include it into chapter 4 and make it their own. And so that's another one of the really exciting things that is happening. There are, two projects that I know of, where instructors are collaborating and adapting, to make their own version of a text. And, you know, I think as much as my heart is with this project, what I would really love to see in the future is someone to make an adaptation that I ended up thinking was of even greater quality than what I was able to produce. And the open licensing allows that to be able to happen. So instead of this restriction that happens with copyright, the open license allows for sharing, for remixing, for editing, for revising. And then the intent is that it will be reshared out with the open community and benefit others.
Awesome. So that's cool. That's helpful for me too. So thinking about the audience for this, because, you know, I think one thing that's important too, and I really liked hearing you earlier talk about who it is that's getting this book and how we often think that the person on the other end of the syllabus, right, is someone who has the money for textbooks, who has 3 or 4 hours a day to sit in the library. We kind of forget that, like, no, a lot of them are driving from campus to campus. They may have kids. They may have a lot of learned helplessness around college, and they may find a lot of this stuff very stressful, and they may not have the money to buy textbooks. So I'm also thinking that what you're doing is you're creating the audience of the book in the material that you choose, because obviously you're choosing to include certain things and not others. And that's not only because you know who's on the other end of the book, but also because you're trying to think of who you want them to imagine themselves to be when they are going through this material, right? Because obviously we don't want to be pedantic, and we don't want to be condescending, and we don't want to be discouraging, but we also don't want to treat them like children, because obviously, you know, many of them, in fact, we forget this, are grown adults who are maybe even on a second career or maybe never imagined themselves in college. So can you talk a little bit about how you chose, or rather did not choose, material to put into the book?
Yeah, I love the way you put that. You put that much better than I would have put it. So thank you for that. I think that one thing that I really strived to do was to collect and curate content that was going to be easily understandable for a student, that was going to deliver a message or a strategy efficiently. And then again, I'm going to come back to that casual tone. I think it really resonates for students when they feel like someone is talking with them rather than lecturing at them. And I think it's easy for textbooks to come across because of the way that they have often always been produced, to come across with that talking at them. And so in addition to trying to identify the content that I wanted to use that was going to be easily understandable and delivering information efficiently, I also wanted to have it come across like someone was talking to someone else. And honestly, I think that was a fairly large risk that I took, because I didn't really know how that was going to go over. And so far, it has been extremely well received.
Yeah, it's been interesting, because you can't make everybody happy, right? So you really have to decide, like, who is the student that I imagine getting the most out of this book? But even still, you know, I've had students who just think they're kind of above. I mean, I'm talking like, they got the best college prep courses. Everyone in their family for several generations has been a college graduate. You know, several people have advanced degrees. And when they get this book and they kind of poo-poo it, like, well, what do I need to know about how to do college? I'll point to a sentence and go, well, did you know this? Or if you knew it, had you considered it? Or are you doing the thing that's in here? I'm like, okay, then maybe you're not too good for it. So you do kind of see a way in which the book speaks to a certain subset, but also the way in which everyone can kind of benefit from this knowledge.
I'm glad you brought that up. I do know exactly the students that you're referring to, and you're absolutely correct. You cannot please everyone. But I have had a number of students who may have started at a prestigious 4-year university. One of them was at an Ivy League school, and for whatever reason, was either transferred or was taking classes back at Grossmont, a 2-year public community college, and usually were taking my class to fulfill some kind of a requirement. It wasn't something that those particular students were seeking out on their own, but I have had a number of those students come back with the realization of not only did this teach me things that I didn't know, but they also in their evaluation will say vindictively, this should be a required course for all incoming students. And I wish that I would have taken this course in my first semester. And that's been extremely rewarding.
It's interesting because we don't have a first year experience for Geneseo, except for the students who come in through our opportunity and access opportunity and economic opportunity programs. And they find that the retention rates of the first year students are 10-15% higher than the generally admitted population. And they have a summer program, a first year experience, they have mentorship, and a lot of the students that come in here, we're sort of assuming that they have everything that they need to succeed because they come from privileged backgrounds, but that's just continuously turning out not to be the case. And one of the things that this book does is make it possible to create your own first year experience for students without necessarily needing that course. You can, you know, I've sent it to my advisees when they have issues with me or with, you know, not with me like interpersonally, but when they bring issues to my attention, I will talk to them one-on-one and I may suggest or draw from this book because, again, it's just got so much material in it. And I also have read it myself for a bunch of reasons, one of which is, have I thought about some of this stuff? So have I thought about like the TED Talks on diversity were very valuable and now I incorporate some of them. So again, the other thing I want to point out to the listeners is that this book isn't just a bunch of advice kind of in a traditional prose format, but it has a ton of multimedia in there that is just, I mean, it's like a treasure trove of multimedia for all kinds of different topics. So do you want to say a little bit about the multimedia component?
Sure. I think that... I'm debating about whether I want to label anything. Let's say that the Netflix generation appreciates audio.
Call them now. You know what they call them now, right?
Probably not.
After the millennials, do you know what the new ones that are coming in the next, like they came in this year and the next couple years are going to be?
No.
The iGens.
The iGens. I have
hate
heard...
it. Right? It's
yes.
Just, I mean, you may as well just call them like the Kleenex generation or the linoleum or the Coke generation. I mean, it's just, anyway, I won't get into it, but yeah, the iGens, I refuse to use it. So I'll be coming up with my own term.
Thank you for giving me the right label. I am well aware that many current students are exposed to hours and hours of video and multimedia and mobile devices. And so I debated for a long time as to what, if anything, I wanted to put in. I didn't want to do it for the sake of doing it. I only wanted to do it if I thought it was going to be well-designed and be able to again, reinforce the concepts that I was trying to get across. And so I started with a pilot of a few TED Talks and a few YouTube videos and could tell that the students really liked them. The students also gave me feedback that that some of the videos were too long. And I said, well, you know, you don't get to have the choice. I understand where you're coming from. They wanted, I think, 7 minutes max, and most of the TED Talks are longer than that. So there is sometimes a bit of a disconnect between the student thinking, okay, I'm investing 15, 16 minutes of my time towards this. Is everything that's in there going towards the concept that you're trying to teach me? And my honest answer is sometimes no. But if I was to try to splice it, it would lose some of the integrity of the entire talk. So I have left those in there in their full form. But I think the feedback on the whole has been overwhelmingly positive, and the students really like seeing those videos. And it's a bit of a break of only reading. And so I have some students that have never been exposed to TED Talks that might think that TED Talks are boring. They get into one or two and they're hooked. And some of them are watching more TED Talks that don't have anything to do with with my class. So, you know, I think, again, that was another risk that has paid dividends. And I am conscious of how much I'm requiring them to watch. And I'm also conscious that I don't want students to substitute and watch the video and not read the content. And so I strive for a balance where hopefully they're not just using the videos as say a Cliff Note version per se, but they're really getting both. And the quizzes are designed so that they really need to be engaged with both in order to be successful.
I mean, I think what's really interesting about this book is that it challenges a lot of the ways that we think about what college is for people. And one of the things is that when we talk about things like giving them multimedia content and being aware that they're only going to do so much and talking about how they can't afford the textbook and talking about how, you know, if you overassign the reading, they're going to turn off, is there's this this tendency to push back and say, well, aren't we just coddling them? And the typical response I hear that isn't the one I'm going to suggest, right, is, well, we have to meet them where they're at. And if that's just what the iGens are doing, then that's just – I mean, I'd rather they learn something than learn nothing at all. But the one that I want to point out, and I think this book does a great job, is that, you know, for centuries, if not thousands of years, like rhetorical theory – I'm talking Aristotle, I'm talking Quintilian, I'm talking the stuff that came out in the 50s and 60s – have talked about this principle of salience, right? So the idea that certain things are going to become important to you and certain things are not. And there is not an unlimited – do you know how phone numbers were invented, the format of phone numbers? Have you ever heard the story? So – when they were trying to come up with phone numbers, when they kind of realized that the old, I think they were like 4-digit codes that came through the switchboard operator weren't going to work anymore, and they were going to have to do area codes plus regional codes plus the 4-digit. So that gave us our, what is it, 10-digit codes we've got now. They actually ran a bunch of focus groups because one of their biggest fears was like, how many numbers is enough and how many is too many? And what if everybody forgets their phone number, right? There was all this anxiety because as we switched from a switchboard method to an automated method, everyone was all freaked out that without an operator there to get you right to the right person, you were never going to know how to get in touch with anybody. And so they did a bunch of focus groups and they figured out through a bunch of different options. And I think this probably would have happened, I don't know, like the 30s. People could remember three sets of numbers if they didn't have more than 4 digits. So they came up with 3, 3, 4. And they figured at the time that would be enough numbers to basically let the phone system grow infinitely, which honestly, and it's worked. I mean, we have not yet run out of, we're starting to run out of certain area codes. I know it's like a big deal now. People are selling their, like certain area codes in LA and New York and Atlanta, people are selling off their area codes, like domain names. But honestly, it works so well, and we still haven't run out of a number system. So I just keep thinking to myself, if in the 30s they decided that the best way someone was going to remember their own phone number, a phone number that they use all the time, was a 3-3-4 rule, then I can only expect my students to remember. And you got to think in a semester, in a day. I mean, this is like where it gets tricky because you can scale it down to be too small. Three major ideas that each have about 3 to 4 components. That's kind of my math. And it's almost a century later. And I think the book really thinks about this principle of salience, right? Every chapter is short, not because they don't have a good attention span, but because A, there's 60 chapters, and B, they only know and can process so much, not because they're lazy children, but because that's just human nature. And it does take advantage of the multimedia content because they are the video generation, just like I was the MTV generation, just like my father was the baby boomer. I mean, you got to make adaptations. And I don't think that's because they're stupider or lazier than the rest of us, but just because they process things through video. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. So again, I think the book does a great job of meeting the students where they are, not because it's pandering, but because it understands that a lot of the reasons that these books need to be rethought, these textbooks, are because college has traditionally presumed so much privilege of students, in many ways to their detriment, that it can't presume anymore.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. And it was never my intention to hold hands or coddle. But to your point, I think I was coming at it from, what's the best way that I can try to deliver information in order for students to understand it, retain it, and be successful with it. And so this was a product of that. And if people are going to accuse of coddling, then, you know, so be it. But I think there's proof that,
exactly,
that it is successful. I have some not yet statistically significant data because of a small sample size, but I have four sections where the success has just been off the chart. 72% wow. of my students with the OER were successful in those four sections, where 48% were successful within about 10 years of classes that were taught. In addition to that, 18% more were retained, and about 27% more received an A grade, 8% more a B grade. The C grades fell slightly. And so if I was wondering, which I was, quite honestly, if this would have any effect, the effect has been overwhelmingly positive. And in addition to the students and the faculty that have complimented the textbook, the true reward is in more students being successful. And to me, it's a little bit of a no-brainer. It's kind of like, if those statistics are accurate, if it's really true that 50 to 60% of the students are not purchasing the textbook because of the issue with the cost, and then all of a sudden you give everyone the resources, well, to me, that's a no-brainer. They should do better, right? I mean, I would think that they would do better. And so that's what some of those statistics are showing.
Great. I mean, I can believe it just through qualitative experience, but if you got numbers to back it up, I think that that's awesome. People will really, I think, respond to that, even if they're skeptical. Because I, for example, had someone recently say to me, well, I want my students to have a print book, because if they don't have a print book, then they don't have it in class and they can't reference it. So I'm not going to go to open educational resources, because then they won't have a print book. And I was like, or you just do an OER and you print it. You bind it and you charge them an extra $8, or give them the option, you know, let them choose, or, you know, get rid of your laptop policy and let them bring the ebook in, or like I said, print it. And I mean, they're just, what I like about this book is it kind of appeals to my, like my dodge and weave kind of approach, which is, you know, when people put up obstacles, like, how do we work around the obstacles? Instead of just assuming that the obstacle is a sign, we should just stop pioneering new methods, right?
Yeah. Well, that's another good point. So on one end of that, I do want print versions of my OER, anyone's OER, to be available if students wish to have them. We're finding that maybe 10% of students prefer or are willing to pay a low fee really solely for the cost of the printing and the paper for that print version. And I'm one who likes the print version. I like to be able to feel and turn the pages, underline or highlight or mark things if I want to. So I want students to have that option. And I was able to find a low-cost printer. So this 456-page text, if it's printed in black and white, costs $8.56. And then they can either purchase it at the bookstore with a small markup or from Lulu.com for $4 shipping. And then I think the other side of that that you were mentioning is when I find that I am educating and advocating for OER, I run into a lot of faculty who may have had the same questions that I have. And I find that there's a pretty stark difference between faculty who are genuinely interested. They might not be there yet, and they might never get there, but they're genuinely interested in learning to see if this might be a good fit for them and learning more about it to see if they can get some of those questions answered the same way that I did. There are other faculty that might say, you know, what about this and what about this and what about this and what about this? And it seems like no matter what answer they may be given or what I could possibly do to satisfy their concern, that they're not going to go. And that's okay. I don't think OER is for everyone, but you know, you were mentioning the person who was kind of not going for OER because print was a barrier. And for a lot of cases, we've solved some of that print challenge.
I mean, I think that's great. And again, the purpose here is more to introduce readers or sorry, listeners to the book than it is to push OER. But, you know, and we do, and NBN is the New Books Network is incredibly grateful to university presses. And we understand that a lot of the costs that university presses incur have to do not with them being greedy or unreasonable, but just because it's just become incredibly difficult to get a lot of copyright permissions these days. I mean, you know, I'm in fact, I have a university press that's doing my first book based on my dissertation, and it's very hard. I mean, it's expensive to get images. And so we're just presenting in this project OER as another alternative and not something that anyone has to adopt, but something to think about. And more importantly, because you've chosen to do an OER book, anyone who's interested now can go to the Rebus community website. And if you just type, this will be a good wrap up because we're coming up on an hour. If you type Rebus, R-E-B-U-S, Blueprint for Success into your browser, I've tried it. You should immediately go to the site where you can download this book in a variety of formats. You can also look for a link in the show notes on the New Books Network, and you can get it right now. And you can send it to students and you can read different chapters and use the multimedia sources in your own teaching and your own research and your own daily entertainment and information gathering. And all that's possible because you chose to do OER. So again, just all things to think about, although still university presses, very grateful for their sponsorship of the podcast.
I had a wonderful experience with the university press that I worked with, and my reasons for going OER had really nothing to do with the university press. So I think there's a lot of really great work going on that university presses are contributing and collaborating with, and I appreciate that.
Well, it's been awesome to have you on. So again, I already gave the website, I'm not going to read out a website, but if anyone's interested, you can go to the Rebus community, Blueprint for Success in College and Career, into your search bar, and you should be taken to a site that will let you download the book if you'd like to look through it. It's an absolute wealth of resources. And I always like to ask my guests whether they have a recommendation for us, either for something that we should listen to or a book that might come on the podcast in a couple of weeks. Do you have anything?
So thank you so much for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure. And I do have a podcast that I'm going to recommend. It's called Beyond the Book, and it's a Copyright Clearance Center podcast with some inside information about the publishing industry on the whole.
Ooh, that's awesome. Man, I learned so much doing this podcast. Cool. I learned about Lulu.com. I learned about, and what is it, Beyond the Press?
Beyond the Book.
Beyond the Book. Okay, Beyond the Book. Well, thank you so much, Dave, for coming on. I'm very excited to see about developments with Blueprint for Success. And you have a wonderful rest of March.
Thanks so much, Lee.
Bye-bye.
Appreciate you having me.
Yeah, bye-bye.